This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Good morning, everybody. What a obedient mob you are. Oh, just hope you can keep it up. Well, actually, it's me you've got to keep in check, really. Anyway, look, welcome to the National Museum of Australia. It's fabulous that you could all come. The symposium was, as you know, advertised rather late, so clearly we got the cream of the crop. And thank you, and you're in for a day that has some of the tone of the exhibition, cheeky and playful and conversational, but always respectful. Before I go any further, though, I really would like to acknowledge Jude Barlow, who's sitting here, and invite her to come to the podium, whatever we call it, and welcome you to country. She's a very well-respected, well-liked Ngunnawal member of the Ngunnawal community. You don't call yourself an elder yet, you do? She's too young. Me too. Anyway, so Jude Barlow, thank you so much for coming. She's been in very hot demand by the museum lately, so we really, really do appreciate.
Good morning, everybody. As Margot said, my name is indeed Jude Barlow, and I'm a Ngunnawal woman. My family are the Wallabaloa people, a family group within the Ngunnawal Nation. And it is, as always, a pleasure and a privilege to be here amongst friends, once again, to represent my family and my ancestors. Now, we Ngunnawal people, we have lived, hunted and raised our families on this beautiful country for over 30,000 years. And our story is one of struggle, but eventual redemption. Because, you see, our voices and our hearts still sing our values, our culture and the spirits that lead us, because we know who we are and we celebrate that. As a representative of my people, I speak with the voice of my family and ancestors when I welcome others to Ngunnawal country. And in doing so, I continue a cultural practice that has been passed down the generations. So, today I welcome you to the land of my ancestors. And I honour my elders past and present, and especially I honour the memory of my beloved dad, Eric Bell. So welcome, each and every one of you. Welcome and travel safely, following song lines that have stood for thousands of years. Welcome to Ngunnawal country.
Thank you so much, Jude. Now you can go do something tedious like shift your office. Sorry to bring you back to the ground so quickly. Well, there's somebody who's coming on next who will take you up again, and that's Matt Trinker, our esteemed director of the National Museum of Australia. He will talk about the significance of songlines to the museum and, you know, our role in telling history, Australian history, in its broadest and deepest sense. I have to say, just to embarrass him, because he always embarrasses me, I have to honestly say I could not see us being able to do a project like this, of this significance, with this logistics, the intense... it's just intense for a very long time, actually. And you just need someone to stay on the road with you, because, you know, he has to deal with, as directors do, with the practicalities of everything else and balancing act. And, you know, it could very easily say, oh, this is getting too hard, it's too long, too much money. You could do that. But I have to say, not at all. He's been unbelievable. Of course, as you may also know, we've had a lot of very important Indigenous exhibitions here in the last, 5-10 years, but quite rapid in the last few years that Matt Trinker has been the director. So I really commend him. If I was doing a job interview for him, he might be. Anyway, Matt, thank you very much for coming in early.
Good morning, everybody, and thanks, Margot. That's very kind. But in truth, you know, the easiest thing in the world is to stay the course with great work. And I do think that in I'm going to take a leaf out of Mick Dodson's book, actually, not just talk about songlines as an exhibition, but as a kind of a portal, a whole body of work. And with this body of work, it has been rather easy to stay the course, not just because of the great commitment of our staff and led by Margot, I think extraordinarily ably by Margot in the course of this project over 7 or 8 years, but also because of the faith invested in us by the communities who really are the stars of this show, clearly, across Māori country, the APY lands, Ngunnawal country as well, in the west. Across all those three vast territories, the communities there have really been the people who strongly advocated for and articulated the need for this body of work. And I am deeply grateful to them. I want to just first begin by adding my acknowledgement and thanks, actually, to Jude's Welcome to Country. It's a great thing to have great friends in the peoples of this land, and Jude Barlow is a great friend of the museum and indeed of many of us in the room. And it's important, I think, to begin this day, but also all the work that we do here at the museum, with that deep acknowledgement that we live and breathe, work on the lands of the Ngunnawal, Ngambri peoples, and joyfully, as a result of the welcome that they give us here in this part of Australia. So I do acknowledge them and their elders, and indeed, especially today, want to acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples from wherever they might be who are in the audience. And in offering those thanks, it seems to me that we're doing something very basic and fundamental in the context of even the discussion that we're having here today. And that is reflecting on how lucky we are. And I know people have heard me say this before, but I never tire of saying it, how lucky we are to be living in a country with this very deep and dynamic human history that stretches back millennia, stretches back into deep time. And I think it's a special thing to be able to walk across this country and know that as you do so, you follow in the footsteps that have been laid down, in a sense, over many thousands of years. And that's a powerful force, an animating force in all our lives, if we just think about it and internalise what it means to live in a lived landscape ourselves that has such a long human story. And I think it's especially germane to this discussion today to reflect on the fact that every part of that terrain, every part of this land, has been the subject of a very deep tradition of story making and storytelling that connects landscape to lived human experience and indeed wider ways of being and knowing. And in this, I'm going to use the word exhibition after having said I wouldn't, you know, taking Mick's admonition to heart from the opening. But in this body of work around songlines, tracking the Seven Sisters, I think the deep truth of this extraordinary genealogy, this lineage of human story making and telling in the Australian landscape is made manifest and it's brought to wider attention. And we learn about the passage of the sisters across this vast swathe of the land and their pursuit by the shape-shifting sorcerer, sometimes by turns called Yerla in Māori country or Wadi Niru in the other lands that I've spoken of already. And this is, in the words of Kim Mahood, who's here and who you're fortunate enough to be hearing from later this morning, just going to quote a section of what she wrote in the catalogue. This is a tapestry of places and events committing knowledge to memory by embedding each component of the story in a particular place and recording it in song. And it is, now paraphrasing her, a landscape seething with threat and desire. And Noel Pearson has described more generally the First Peoples' songlines of Australia as this continent's Iliad and Odyssey, or perhaps its Book of Genesis. And I think these kinds of analogies do have some utility, especially for helping non-Aboriginal peoples make sense of the scale and the narrative power of songlines. But of course, the meaning and the fundamental importance of songlines are entirely their own, and they manifest the deep relationship between country, culture and cosmology. And it is true that there are many peoples in the world who, not just the Greeks, who have narratives that centre on the idea of the Seven Sisters. It's a common trope in human storytelling, anchored as they often are in the Pleiades constellation of the night sky. So in another respect, these Seven Sisters stories, the Seven Sisters stories of songlines, which are in themselves incomplete in the broader Australian context in the sense that they focus on a part of the country, songline stories about the Seven Sisters stories, rather, are common to many First Peoples of this land. But these stories sit alongside other great traditions that have sought to connect this star cluster, and human experience on Earth. And I want to leave it, and rightly leave it, to the peoples of Mardu country, of Ngunnawal country, and the APY lands to speak their stories of the Seven Sisters and explain their meaning and relevance, as I have done in this exhibition and will continue to do in other places as well. It's for them, really, to tell those stories. But I do want this morning, because I have the chance really, to thank them from the bottom of my heart for sharing them. Sharing those narratives with us through this show. And I think that openness is really a gift. It's one that's taken a lot of courage and commitment of those people, a preparedness to really to take us inside their world and to patiently explain their stories. And in another respect, to trust in our capacity to tell those stories accurately, or at least render them accurately and respectfully. And I, for one, am frankly overwhelmed at what's been achieved in this body of work. I'm overwhelmed by their achievement, and indeed the achievement of Margot Neal and others at the museum who've worked hand in hand with the peoples of the lands over many years, from about 2010, in fact. So to Margot, I also want to offer my heartfelt appreciation for the sheer excellence of this program and what has been achieved in bringing these fundamental narratives of this land to a wider public. I also want to acknowledge the work of the Australian National University, to Howard Morphy and Diana James and other partners in the project Alive with the Dreaming, Songlines from the Western Desert, which was funded by the Australian Research Council, and also to Sarah Kenderdine and her team for their work in creating what I think is one of the great experiences I've had in a museum anywhere, and that is the experience of being in the dome that story, as well as a visit almost virtually to Cave Hill. Now, the National Museum has a central commitment to bringing to life the Australian story, if we can call it that, in all its dimensions. And we take it very seriously. And at the core of that, I think, is that responsibility to represent the histories and experiences of the continent's First Peoples in their own words, by working with them and being guided by them. And as a museum, we also place a great deal of emphasis in really context and broader social meaning. For us, for instance, works of art are not just aesthetic delights, but rather their real importance lies in their cultural relevance and power. And I think that's one of the key features of the Songlines exhibition, really. This exuberant delight in the power of stories, story making and storytelling. Whether it's in the direct voice of elders inviting us into their world, or the works of art, or the multimedia installations, or the records of live performances, all the elements in Songlines comprise a vision of humanness as something that's deeply enmeshed with the practice of making and telling stories, making narratives of our lives. And it's this, I think, that is part of the reason, at least, that the show has provoked such strong emotion and widespread acclaim amongst a broader public. And in many ways, I think the exhibition reminds us that storytelling, story making, is deeply productive of human experience as well as reflective of it. And in this, I'm thinking of Jonathan Gottschall and others who've written about the ways in which stories help us navigate life's complex problems and actually ensure our survival. And this way of thinking, we're the product of our stories as much as the producers of them. And perhaps we may, in fact, cease to be human without them. Perhaps it's storytelling itself which literally brings us into being and makes us human. And I think that this itself is a story, it's an insight, at this time when the rise of technology can sometimes almost make us feel as though our essential humanness is in danger of being overwhelmed. Who hasn't worried where the rise of AI and the world of ones and zeros will end? Worried about what it will mean to be human by the end of this century, of the 21st century. And at the heart of Songlines, I think, there's this deep affirmation of the irreducible connectedness of story and human life, with the clear implication that our stories and our narratives are the chief source of a shared human distinction and meaning. So, not for the first time, I'm struck by how the vigorous, dynamic story-making and storytelling of Indigenous Australians actually can prompt us to a wider apprehension of what really matters in our lives. Here again is a guide to us to how we might think about what it means to live as a human on the planet, and how we might strive, in a sense, to recover this capacity to be deeply human and really to belong in fundamental ways. And when you look at it that way, what a gift, what a great gift these stories, these song lines have been for all of us who are lucky enough to walk and live in this land and to share in its stories. I commend to you the rest of today's proceedings. I wish I was able to join you for the rest of the speakers today, but I know that you'll be thrilled, delighted, and taken into places you hadn't quite have imagined through the course of the day. Thank you for your time.
Story. Look, that was very inspiring. It never ceases to amaze me how deeply Matt gets this. It actually almost embarrasses me because I'm often thinking, oh my God, how come I didn't get that? So it's really inspiring, and I don't mean to embarrass him, but you all will agree that there's a lot of things said in there that does what we hope this exhibition will do, and is broaden thinking to the whole sense of humanity in relationship to each other and to country, that connectiveness, which we think is probably what touched people to get the responses that we have. Now, I have to do something really boring like housekeeping, sorry. Okay, he might pop in and out if he's allowed. He has a higher boss. So I can't find the housekeeping, so you're saved. Let's see you somewhere. I suppose the most important part to say is that it's been recorded and streamed. So I got a bit nervous about the stream, but evidently it'll be 3.5 people and then it's all gone. And the recording, of course, we can edit that or if there's any big issues, because I don't want anyone to feel cramped, you know, in having the conversation that they want to have. And I am looking forward to a sort of real free-flow conversation with not too much formality at all. So you won't get the sort of the established standing up here kind of talking in the normal formal sense mostly. So some people feel better doing that, and that's cool. Now, I've been introduced, here you are, and I'm also of Aboriginal and Irish descent. I always say this is not on my business card. Of Aboriginal and Irish descent, I was born and raised in Gippsland, in the Kulin Nation, but have really stronger connections probably with Goombunga country, clan connections there, and with Wiradjuri. So I would also like to acknowledge Jude Barlow's welcome and the local people here and acknowledge their presence as I won't even repeat that, but I also would like to acknowledge others, Aboriginal people who have long connection to this region, and they include the Ngarrigo, the Numich, the Wolgaloo, the Wallabaloo, Pialigo, Monaro, and many others, because this was very much a transit zone around here. And even though it's been a seat of government for 90 years, it has been a seat of government for Aboriginal people for 20 to 30,000 years. And it is really the knowledge and stories about this place are really sort of just coming, bubbling to the surface. It's quite different here than many others, because there's no capacity for native title determination here. So people got to sort it out in the community. So it's an ongoing story, that one. excuse me. And as you can see from the program, there's a fabulous lineup of speakers, and we're all very excited to hear them, and I hope they don't get nervous. And if they do, we'll knock it out of them. So I'd like to acknowledge the community. I'm just going to work out, can I take this mouse right across, or do I have to stand there? I can't do both. And like I said before, I hope the tone of the day is in the tone of the exhibition, because as you probably know, the exhibition is the communication portal, as Mr. Dodson so descriptively referred to it. Now, I think what I do need to say is I'd like to acknowledge community custodians of the Seven Sisters who are virtually... I just want to know how... Oh, here. Okay, sorry. Sorry about my ignorance. Just want to acknowledge their presence, not in the room. They'd find this terribly boring. They had their day before the exhibition, their day, they're still having the day, but in the days before the opening, and I'll just scroll through so you get an idea of who's who. These are in the catalogues if you're lucky enough to have one, so you can, you know, read more about who they are. But they are... they're very present, as you know, in the exhibition, digitally, virtually, even where they've been, they're very present. And before the exhibition opened, and the days before, there's this fabulous situation where the mobs had all sort of, representatives at least of the mobs had all sort of come together from all these different regions. And it was a man called Mr. Bernard Newbury, from Ngunnawalli lands, did in fact replicate it in a way, the way this whole exhibition was originated. It was an initiative on his part to call together all of the Aboriginal... Oh, this is, I'm showing you the presence in the exhibition. There's Mr. Newbury. And he thought, well, what a great opportunity. We've got all these people here. Why don't we all sort of catch up with each other and join up these song lines? It's a bit like TV series. I don't necessarily know what came before or what came after. So he took on the initiative, find us a room, you know, have your cameras ready and your recording and I'll bring them in. It was almost like in little groups at a time. And they spoke all in language. And there's Mr. Newbury on the right. And they did almost of a day, which, you know, is still in language, because we now have a fabulous project, which we call a legacy project, in which we'll unlock a lot of that, and we'll, you know, record and we'll go back and do all the usual processes and then encourage him and him to infect others to do the same. So the song lines, in fact, will never end, and this project will go on in that way, but from a community initiative. Slow, fast, who knows, stop, start, but we've already set it in place for the legacy. And here is already talking to Madu man. So he's Nunnery, he's talking to a Madu young fella. So this cross, generational transfer is sort of in progress well before. And similarly, others are doing the teaching the young fellas about the stories by bringing them here. This is Brenda Douglas from the APY lands. And, of course, Inawindji Williamson, who was a very... I want to acknowledge her especially as a very senior, powerful woman, powerfully positive woman, who we needed... It was a go-to person. And Dinah James, who's here, has had a very long relationship with her, and she's such a can-do and made everything, you know, much easier. And we learned a lot from her. Now, Curtis Taylor, who's also... Here's one. So we could talk about the young fellas here. The whole project was actually an example of what the big concern is for the elders, because Curtis was involved with the film, as you saw, in the exhibition, and the only other young person really that actually did stay with the game was Tapaya Edwards. Unfortunately, I haven't got his image here. But he's got the clue. You've just got to do a different way from now on if you want to keep these song lines alive. And this is what the day is about, future-proofing the song lines, but basically ground-proofing them for future-proofing. And he's on to it. Now, also, while we're at it, I'd like to acknowledge other people who are involved. Clearly, you can't do everyone, but I'm just those close to the ground here with us on the exhibition and in a little bit different parts of the journey was who worked with me is Christiana Keller and Sita for the last 18 months. McAlpine Claire Freer worked with the Arts Centre Hub, and before that the members of the ARC and ANU that Matt has already mentioned, and Andy Greenslade, who's just come on board for the next part of our journey. And sorry, anyone I've missed. But there you go. And Kim Mahood, who's sitting down there, you'll hear about her in a minute. She was a great contributor for the exhibition texts. So today, as I said, is very focused on the exhibition. You know, why? Because it has been truly an overwhelming response. I was going on about... I mean, look, people say congratulations to me and it feels terribly embarrassing. And I say, really, this exhibition has taken on a life of its own. It's sort of like you've had a difficult and very protected birth and then this wonderful child appears and it develops its own life and it runs away and you can admire it from a distance. So it kind of feels like that. It's really absolutely taken a life on of its own. And clearly, because there's a lot of people involved in I'm talking about the actual exhibition, not the whole process, which is a lot of people involved in that conception and development. So what it does, one more thing I must say. Yesterday we were taking the groups around. I've been saying, isn't it remarkable? There's people flying all the way from Darwin and Perth, and we've got one of them here today, Lisa, to see this exhibition. I mean, you know, that's sort of quite a commitment, really, and it's word of mouth. And then yesterday, I don't know who was it you, John? Yesterday, someone said, I flew from New York. There she is, hands up. I said, not only for this, surely you had other business. Nah, I heard about it on Facebook, and you can tell us later when we open it up. Saw her on Facebook in November, just had to come. So it'll be very interesting to hear, you know, from you later. So, I think the other thing is that what we need to do with this is what is it that touches people? How do I unpack this? What's its legacy? How is it going to help inform what happens, you know, what happens next in terms of even exhibition style, mode? What does it say about Australian history? what does it say about art? You know, because in a way, it's not an art exhibition. It's not a history exhibition. It's not a science exhibition. It's all of them. And whatever else we may discover lurking in the corners when we speak about it today. It's both an Australian Aboriginal exhibition and a universal story of mankind. It offers us that connectivity that Matt was talking about to each other and to our planet, if you like, in a fragmenting world. This is what we hope will help the internationals buy it too, that it's connected to them as well. So with this sort of authenticity and spirituality, it has the power to truly unify us as fellow travellers, even if momentarily. So I think it grounds us, it has the capacity to ground us together with our common ancient roots. So that might be big, but I think we can move in that direction or other directions that may come out. But my, for those who were on the tour yesterday, and me like Matt, you may have heard some of this before. If you've been on the tour, I've been saying it for about, 5 months, it is a curatorial mantra that I have, and I think it has some pertinence to this, and it goes way back to the Asia-Pacific triennial days. And the character and quality of an exhibition is determined by the quality and character of the journey that precedes it, and hopefully the journey that postdates the exhibition. Now, when you think of the genesis of this exhibition, and I'm going to be more generic here, but, you know, some elders came to us and ANU and others with an urgent plea. It was particularly David Miller, and a girl I'm thinking of, but it was overall the feeling that we need your help to put the songlines together. They've all been broken up. That's the sentiment. And they're talking particularly about the younger people, and it's not being passed on. And all you people here would know that the Aboriginal story, the history is embedded in the land. The way it keeps alive is through constant activation. So, you know, that is a concern. So they wanted to... They were proactive. They knew exactly what they needed to do, and they wanted us to help them track it. We're knowledge holders from the other side. Track it. Deposit in Ara Iritija, which is the Aboriginal Managed Archive in Alice Springs, so that when the young fellas and girls come to their senses, as they absolutely entirely believe they will, it's there at least when they're gone. So hopefully we can, through this process, exhibition and all the things that come from it, also have a couple of other strands running in that direction. So this is the thrust of the day. Excuse me, lots of talking. So when that's the genesis, then, of course, you're talking about a journey exhibition. The song lines are journeys across land, the curatorial process then has to be, the researcher proceeded has to be a journey, the curatorial process has to be a journey, therefore the exhibition has to be a journey. And given its genesis... Then the more stories on the ground. then, given its genesis, I did say ground proofing. So given the genesis, therefore the Aboriginal people, the custodians, are not an advisory group. They're not a reference group. They have to be the curators. So we are a curatorium. So all those have had input formed a curatorium. Sorry, I was talking about the journey, and this is that's what the pictures were showing you, some of the journey on the ground. So this is a very small selection of the curatorium. Who were here on the day, basically, for the photo. We went to their office... They came to our office and they hung around and engaged in the dome once it was open and stayed for quite a while. So it's very much then a multi media. It's sort of like a I think of it in terms of it's a bit of a boundary rider exhibition that fits everywhere but fits nowhere. And that's how it needs to be. It's multi-dimensional, of course, and you have Murray George and Anawari Mitchell here with the VR, the collisions VR that Lynette Walworth will speak about later, and I'll also mention something about it. And guess who we found in there? It's him and her. So, you know, again, the range of people who have visited and done all the whole experience of, you know, just, you know, it'll come out during the day. It's just unbelievable. Yesterday was the Underwater Sea Cable Task Force who got an after-hours delegation, you know, here on Monday, yeah, from the Solomons, Vanuatu, PNG. I mean, you could just talk about the range of people that have been not who you would normally expect. So I have to say we must have broadened our audience somewhat. So it is a multi-dimensional exhibition. You know, it's a boundary ride, as I said. It pioneers new terrains, crosses boundaries, and I think offers portals into other worlds and ways of seeing. Now, this is the intention, and this has been sort of the feedback. So it can be experienced, as I said, as either a fine art exhibition with immersive multimedia or as a history narrative with universal relevance to all civilizations. But beyond the visual surface, it expresses a knowledge system, or it exposes, rather, a knowledge system embodied in the land, drawing on the universal themes or issues of ecology, climate, geography, and cosmology in an experiential way. And the visits to this exhibition engage in a wild chase across the Australian deserts as part of the ancient creation saga, along the song lines through the deserts that have already been mentioned. But the visitors are basically invited to journey and walk in the footsteps of the Seven Sisters. So when I say tours, I say it's one thing to, you know, get a sense of what the song lines mean as corridors of knowledge or pathways of knowledge, but it's another thing to get a sense of how they work. So without getting too twee about it, we used the top of plinths, you know, in a subtle kind of way, and the paintings are not there because they're paintings, they're there because they're portals to place. And again, Matt touched on that. So I'll just finish up with, from a community perspective, generally speaking, it's clearly, just show you what I've got left, it is clearly a about the Seven Sisters' songlines and their journey across those deserts. That's what it's about, right? And there's no dispute. But from a museum perspective, it's an Australian history exhibition. And I think from a visitor perspective, you can't actually tab it. It's all of the above and a whole lot more. And I think the comments, I think if I just seize on something, it's that everybody felt like they were part of the exhibition in some way. You know, I mean, this is the one I think I hear most commonly. They feel part of it. They feel like they're a participant in a performance. They feel like it unlocks some doors. Oh, the classic, the one I really like, Christine Nichols came up in the conversation saying, the publication online said, it moved the furniture around in my... It rearranged the furniture in my head. So, you know, I think that's something worth thinking about. And others are basically that, really. I think there's heaps, but very much they really love, you know, Aboriginal things. They go to lots of exhibitions and they admire the people and the culture and the artwork, but they never, like, they never really feel it's anything to do with them. And this one, they're coming out saying, I feel like it's everything to do with me. In fact, like a responsibility in a way that has a practical capacity to do something. So they're saying things like, because the fellas at the digital, the virtual elders or the elders at the front are saying, along with us, who were all part of the curatorium, and you, if you look close, it you'll get it. If you live in Australia, you need to know your story. Very Aboriginal way of thinking. You need to know your story. Well, you mightn't know it because you're only looking at the last 220 years. So we're here to teach you your story. And I think that sort of comes through by the fellas popping up all over the place through the show. So it is about together we are fellow Australians travelling, living on, sharing this continent here. It's not a lovely bunch of really generous people simply saying this is our story but happy to share it with you. So I think, you know, that there's something in that to unpack. Now, I stuck to time. That's remarkable. So let's see what other perspectives are stimulated by this exhibition, and particularly, you'll see with these speakers, particularly couched in their own grounded experience. So on that note, I would like to let the journey begin with Kim Mahood. Now, Kim is, as far from being grateful for her artistry with some of the text panels, we would like to have her talk about the way stories... Oh, I didn't tell you about it, but anyway, the way stories, future-proofing the stories, some of it is about retelling them in different modes to match changing circumstances. And, of course, if these songlines of stories aren't changing continually, they will not stay alive. So, you know, they have to be contemporised and told by different people in different ways. So I'd just like to introduce you to Kim when I can find... Must be, were they my pages that fell over? Not that I need to. So Kim, as many of you will know, is an author, she's a curator, she's a writer, she's a bush girl, she has a truck with a dog in the back, and she's the author of, particularly of the award-winning memoir Craft for a Dry Lake, and the much-circulated essay, which is how I sort of knew of her, Cardia Are Like Toyotas. If you haven't read it, you must. Her latest book, Position Doubtful, explores the relationship between Aboriginal and settler Australians and between people, art and country in the Tanami Desert. She's coordinated enormous collaborative projects. She has to be the queen of collaboration across artists, custodians, scientists, facilitated lots of cultural and environmental mapping projects. And she worked as a consultant and facilitator and writer for the Canning Stock Route Art project you may have seen, it, which I think is a pioneering piece of work, and that's the Mardu Art Project, We Don't Need a Map. And, of course, this one, Seven Sisters and the Seven Sisters Songlines. So her practice actually explores that interface between Aboriginal and Western representations of landscape and country, but I'd say much more, really. We just haven't got the words for them yet. So I'd like to invite Kim up. You'll be a bit lonely. Can we all... Thanks, Kim. We're all into embarrassing each other here today.
Absolutely. At least I'm so small. I barely show over the podium. Let's do this. I'll just see if I can get the technology to work. Yes, there we are. I always feel a bit of a fraud in this sort of context because basically where my knowledge comes from is being a dog's body with a Toyota. And you just happen to be there to facilitate people to do the things they want to do. Margot asked us, a few of us, to bring in some case studies. I did work on the Songlines project and it was a revelation and just a fantastic privilege to be part of and a great learning process as well. But the story I'm going to tell is actually from the area which I work in most of the time, which is the Tanami and Southeast Kimberley, with people I've been associated with since I was very young. And the story, the actual song line, is The Two Dogs Dreaming Story. This is a painting which we'll return to, done by the rangers at Mullen, which is a small community next to Baraku or Lake Gregory. And the song line is that the two dingoes, a male and a female, who create the lakes. They come down from, they come across from the east and then down the down Sturt Creek. They separate. The male dog, the black dog, creates the deep lake, the darker blue saline lake, and the female, the white dog, creates the western shallow freshwater lakes. They meet at the junction at the bottom, and they kill a couple of emus. They have a big party. They come out along the top. I'm not sure. I don't think I can work the technology to show you the actual site, but it's a creek. Hang on, that one. Oh yeah, let's see if I can do this. Here we go. So they come down here, they meet here, they head up and they go out along this creek and they go into the ground. That's where they are still today. That's actually just an aerial, a Google shot of the site that they travel along called Bungabiddy Creek. The other interesting thing about this site is that in 2008, Jim Bowler, Mike Smith and Peter Veth did an archaeological excavation on Jim's behest because the suggestion was that the lake, which was a mega lake back in the sort of Pleistocene, Holocene era, had been occupied for a very long time. And what happened was they unearthed a core stone, a flake stone, that because it was in situation, they were able to date at 50,000 years. Anyway, a couple of years later, I was part of one of the many projects I've facilitated. I was sort of co-coordinator with the artist Mandy Martin on a project called Desert Lake to bring together the sort of art, science and stories of the area. Mandy had done something similar out in the Channel Country and had approached me because I had a sort of lot of resources. We could immediately go into sort of fairly deep terrain because I'd been working out with the Wamadjari at Lake Gregory for many years. Anyway, one of the things Mandy wanted to do was to have a painting where we all collaborated, Aboriginal artists and white artists together. And I guess part of what I want this story to do too is show how the best laid plans of white fellas get derailed and what a good thing that usually is. So I thought the site where this excavation had occurred was a good location that we could all go out and work on. It also lent itself to the five-panel sort of layout or template because of the creek. So I put together, I painted the template, and here we are on site. And I'm just explaining. Of course, I spoke with all the traditional owners about it being an appropriate site. That was fine. Yes, they were very happy to do that. So on the day, we're all out there, the sort of Whitefella team and all the elders and a whole lot of rangers. There were more rangers around on that day than I'd seen in years because something exciting was happening. And normally there was only sort of two or three, but we had about seven present on that day. I was explaining what we were going to do along with the senior custodian of the of that particular site and story, Hanson Pye. So we were discussing how we would set about doing this, this contingent of, or coterie, I often think of them, of women elders listened for a while and then they said, "No, that's not going to happen. Not like that. This part right here, this is a men's story. Women can't. It's way too dangerous for women to mess with. And so the men have to paint it. And, you know, there just happened to be, because of the circumstances, you know, this would not have happened if we hadn't been trying to do this project. There we were. There's seven young and middle-aged men all there together and all there sort of, you know, aunties and grandmothers and people who can actually make them do things that us white fellas can't. And they sort of said, nope, the women have to stay up here, you know, on the ridge and just more or less, you know, make the place safe, and the men have to do the painting. Mandy was pretty put out. You know, she's not used to having her plans sidelined, but there was a much greater authority there on the day. So now the only painter among them was Hansen. None of the other guys had ever painted anything, so they took the template down next to, it's very close to where the actual cobblestone was, the core stone was found. And they have a discussion, and at this point I'll just say there's no problem at all for me showing these images. It was just that, you know, I was not able to witness the process on the day. And in fact, the photographs were mostly taken by John Carty, who was at the, he was the sort of anthropologist on that particular project, and of course now is over at the South Australian Museum. So they started out by looking at what they were going to do. Hansen had, there was a tiny image that of a painting his father, who now deceased, was also a custodian for that location, had painted the story of the two dogs killing the emus and then going into the ground. So he had a tiny little image of that in an Indigenous Protected Area pamphlet. So they used that as a reference point. And Hansen then decided he would make the first marks. And it's quite significant what he's doing here, because he has now inherited the story that was his father's and his uncle's of the two men who are carried by the two dingoes as stones, and they're put down nearby and become the brothers, the two hills, the Ngunbajara. And so Hansen, the first thing he does is paint in the Ngunbajara, who are also associated with his father and his uncle. Then the next thing they're going to do is put in the tracks of the two dogs, which initially they co-opt Hansen's little dog Socks and paint his paws to see whether that will work. Socks refuses to cooperate. So the guys take a panel each and they paint the tracks in. And what is interesting here, of course, is that this is the first time these particular young men have had the opportunity to participate in such a sort of practical way with retelling this story, re-engaging with it. Of course, the white fellas think this is great. The blokes, they get down, you know, to participate in the serious stuff of painting. Well, you know, us women have to stay up on the ridge and talk girl stuff, like skin names and whatever. And of course, they get in the photograph. The work, as you can see, is starting to really progress. And the at this point, the painters decide to go down somewhere, because it's a pretty bleak old location, as you can see. They decamp down into the nearby creek, which is the actual route that the two dingoes take as they head for their final, for their water hole that they've gone into the ground. John continued to stay with them and take photographs. The only other person who remains with them is Bill Fox, who is he heads up the Nevada Museum of Art and the Environment. He was over to sort of participate in the progress in the project. He's sort of sitting like a Guardian gnome in the scrub behind. Bill witnesses something which he interprets as the painting out of the Guardian mark, you know, from the original template for the path of the dogs, and then laying in a new path. That may be what happened. I also think what's quite likely is that because they all started out independently, everyone painted the dingo tracks in a different way. So the purpose of it was to make a new path and just paint them all the same, which is what they proceed to do. Either way, one person is then chosen to paint all the tracks, and this is what they end up with. Now, you can see how incredibly proud they all are. They're really delighted with what they've done. And, of course, the painting now has far too much gravitas to be allowed to be taken out of the community and be part of the exhibition, which is it's for. So, and there's $4,000 going spare to pay for it. So Hanson and Jamie asked me to produce another template. They don't seem to be too bothered that, you know, this sort of middle-aged white female is being part of the story. And they do the replica, which, you know, doesn't have the significance. It can leave the community. And, you know, they get the money. And so here it is. Here's the replica. It's on show in Alice Springs at Araluen. And Hanson is telling the two dogs story to an absolutely rapt audience. And what's happened for him in the process is that the two dingoes and the two brothers have kind of morphed. And they have become, it's just been too irresistible, the sort of, this songline sort of convergence, the location convergence, because the site where the two dingoes go into the ground is right next to where the brothers are. So he actually changes the ending of the story with this sort of rapt white fella audience, and it's the first time he's been in that sort of situation, and it's gone to its head a bit, actually. So he gets really, you know, wound up about this the two dingoes. He interprets the black dingo as the younger brother whose hair is still black, and the white dingo as the older brother whose hair's gone white. As it happens, the wife of the now deceased older brother is there on the day in the audience. And she pulls him up on it. She won't let him get away with it, you know, forget the audience, anything else. And he has to sort of backpedal and recant and apologise. And, you know, she's still alive. She's still a very strong woman, someone I work with a lot, and just, you know, one of those fantastic people that thoroughly enjoys articulating their deep knowledge. But Hanson has, in his way, and he is now the surviving senior custodian of the story, he takes on the account of the discovery of the cobblestone, the core stone, by the archaeologists. And so he paints that story. The dark layer is deep time. The stone, which has been the flaked stone, which is evidence of that sort of very long association, it exists. It sits right here. What is above is the present day and into the future. And that point where that stone has been found, Hanson sees as where the dreaming sits there at that site, where deep time and the present day come together. And what he's done is paint an H for Hanson right at that spot. Now, his uncle and his father were the two stones that the dingoes put down, male or female, who cares in Hanson's view. And he has associated himself with that stone that was found by the archaeologists, and in that way has co-opted the scientific story into both the dreaming and into himself. He's taken it over. Where the story goes from here, I don't know. It's just a fascinating process, which I watch, you know, it's always amusing to see what people do. It's humbling. It keeps you on your toes, and I'll leave my part of the story there. Thanks.
Now, that's a perfect example. Huh? What? Oh, thank you, Kim. That's fabulous. She's a storyteller for sure. Look, if people want to... It's open up. You can have a little talk about it. Do you want to talk to Kim? Questions, make comments. We'll do it as we go. Now, you have to do the dreaded mic thing, say who you are, then you say something. So is anyone there, anyone around with a comment? Huh? Yeah. I mean, we don't have to do it now. You might still be digesting it, in which case you can have a bit of indigestion later. Huh? Yeah. No, but I still... Sometimes people feel compelled to ask a question. Okay. Not so. So we're moving on now to Scott Cain. Scott is a consultant, another man deeply grounded in stories in the country, and works very collaboratively and closely with community over the years. He's a consultant archaeologist and anthropologist who has lived and worked throughout Australia for the last 30 years. Is that all? is that all you're telling? He has provided expert advice and sort of native title claims, and resulted in, you know, assisting in the successful recognition of rights to over 400,000 square metres of land. He's written how I came to know of him, because for me too, in his expedition, have moved into many territories that previously were unknown to me, archaeology and anthropology. I knew him through the Pilangura, the Spinifex people and first footprints, the epic stories of the first Australians. And it too, for those who haven't read it or seen it, it's visual as it is textual, is very, it's very much like what's happening here. It fits in both places, and it deals with the visual as sort of cultural narrative. So Scott's going to... have a little talk about song as religious belief and traditional lore, and he's actually sort of called it like a yarn up, where songlines argues where he argues that songlines record both history as myth, and in regard to history provide tangible proof that Aboriginal religion is the oldest and yet least known faith on earth. So you can see how that dovetails beautifully with Kim's. Thank you, Scott.
Well, I've got to say that I wrote the abstract. Well, actually, wrote the title for the talk before I'd written the abstract. I wrote the abstract for the talk before I'd written the talk. I wrote the talk before I saw the exhibition, so... I don't know what I'm going to talk about, but it dovetails quite well, I think, with the exhibition. I assume everyone here has been to the exhibition, and everyone's probably been on the guided version of the exhibition, so it helps me to know what people know when I kind of say things that they all think are nonsense. So, look, what I want to talk about is songlines, and in the context of their ongoing future-proofing, and some of the themes which are in my abstract I mightn't actually get to, but I'll try, right? And to do that, I've got to talk about songlines as I understand them. And my glasses are so dirty, I can't even see my own paper. So, look, for me, songlines are actually better thought of as gospels. And for me, they're principles, beliefs, principles, teachings of a religious tradition. And they're embedded in land, and they articulate society's laws and customs in relation to that land, amongst other things. I think they're more than telling stories. I think knowledge of songlines is the primary vehicle for acquiring social prestige and political power. And I think they're the ultimate determinant of rights in land. Now, for me, songlines is a good term. I know Bruce Chapman used it, and in its odd way popularised it and devalued it, but it is the word that Aboriginal people use themselves. I'm working in Grid Island at the moment, and there people have a sort of a totemic inheritance where they become consubstantial with some element of their of their environment, and that's their totem. But of course, they don't have the word totem. That's a European term. If you wouldn't say to a person on Grid Island, what is your totem? You would say, what is your song? And if you ask that question, if I've got this right, they would... I just finished this 2 days ago. It's a sketch still of all the song lines, right? From Grid Island to Live by Bay on the mainland, between Ngalnu, Nogabuyu and the Yakka country. And as you can see, there's shitloads of them. So once you know their song line, you know who they're related to, you know what the political and religious allegiances are, there's connections between moieties and clans, between clans and people who are on the same religious journeys. People who live next door to each other are not as close as the people live on who are connected through song. It's a very complicated system. And there's lots. All of those songs, all of those lines, there's a few there, are known and all sung, and all alive and well. Now, the importance of this in the context of contemporary future-proofing, as the traditional law articulated through song lines, is vital, in my experience, through most of the traditional heartlands, I guess, of Australia. So I go to this again, yeah? And these are the ones that I vaguely know. Scale of song lines. Now, because song lines articulate the law, and I meant L-A-W, law, they're an essential ingredient in the transfer and maintenance of that law. Song lines, in a sense, future-proof themselves, because without song, there's no traditional learning. Without educational learning, there is no traditional law. And without traditional law, there is no social status, no political power, and effectively no traditional society. Now, the question is then how song lines are learned. Now, song lines are learned through initiation. The process of initiation starts with young men, but then as people, initiates themselves, become older, they participate in the process until they're very old men, and when they become actually as old as me, they are free, finally. It's a lifetime of learning. Free, they would say, to speak and act without question or contravention. They become Ngurra Walcha, they become literally a human relation to the land that they have a ritual relationship to. Now, Jilkages is the word for the initiation ceremonies in the desert. I don't know what the audience knows, so I'll say these things in general terms and hopefully it's interesting information. If not, you know it. So it doesn't matter. Jill could just start with the movement of a special boy who takes a hair belt and goes on effectively a ritual pilgrimage with an entourage through the desert to visit places and communities as part of his religious learning. All the host communities that are encountered on that journey have to return to the host community to participate in the initiation, in the Jilkaja. Now, these are massive ritual pilgrimages. Everybody has to travel. People travel massive distances. The initiation ceremonies might include 500 to 1,000 people. There was a big Kuna Pipi at Ngumuwa last year, which had 1,500 people. It took 6 months to complete. Cost as a base cost $167,000. There's one that's just finished at Junanjara in the southern part of the desert, which was big enough for the local store to not be able to feed people. It was turning over $20,000 a day just to maintain the population that were participating in this religious activity. The ritual route is closed when these things happen. If you're a white person, you're a government person, you're a policeman, a health worker, me, you can't access the roads when the religious entourage moves through. Now, I'll give you a sort of a scale here. Now, the largest Jilkages will include, that's the same map, and obviously that's Europe stuck over the same space. So the largest pilgrimages, right? The largest pilgrimages go from, they'll go down to Junanjara and they'll move through the whole of sort of central Australia. So they effectively go from Ireland out to Germany and down into Spain and Portugal. I mean, these are massive journeys, and I think they're the largest religious pilgrimages on earth. And I did a quick sort of internet check beforehand just to make sure. So if I'm standing in Jordan at the place that Moses was meant to look across to the promised land, and I want to travel to Mecca, it's only 800 k's, right? I can get on a plane. If I want to drive from Istanbul to Mecca, right, I can get on Highway 35 and be there in 35 hours, but you can't drive through Syria at the moment. But these distances, it is a 3,000-kilometre journey
from the north of those Ritual Lines down through the centre out to Gunungurra, 6,000 return. So these are massive religious pilgrimages in my view, and point being, I don't think anyone knows they even happened. I don't think anyone knows there's a Jilgaja on at the moment between Hart's Bluff and Kintore, across basically most of the central part of Germany and France. Or that won't just finish at Gunungurra. They happen all the time, and I think they're one of the most profound religious events on earth, and they're kind of an invisible event in Australian history. Sorry, I keep moving away. Yeah. I can't start again, so I'll just kind of keep rambling on, yeah? Now, the thing is, what are they learning, right? Well, participants in the Jilgaja are basically learning the Gospels, which we'll call songlines, which they are songlines, of their religious traditional lore. Now, these religious teachings encompass thousands of kilometres of country, as I've said, and they link people and they define people and country. And they're manifested in different ways, and I'm going to try something now which actually isn't going to quite work, but I'll do it anyway. And weirdly, I'm just talking about country a little bit south of Paraku, where Kim was talking about here. So you have the vision of a generalised version of the big song lines there. You get an idea of the scale of these things. And, of course, all these are still sung and known. They're not extinct. Seven Sisters in there. I'll come back to that, right? And then I don't know what's going to happen next. So this is a simpler... Okay, so let's go back. Can I go back? How do I go back? Can I go this way, don't I? Okay, so go back. So I've got so many things in my hand now. I don't know what I'm doing. Right? I don't know which thing to press. Right? So we'll go... This is going to be really difficult. But there, where that thing's wobbling, there's three, four lines there. But if I zoom in on that, just so I can have an appreciation of the tapestry of song lines, and now I go down... That little bit is actually that. There's that many songs. There's two or three major song lines. There's Red Kangaroo. There's Wadi Kudra, which I want to talk about later. It has lots to do with your dingoes, I think, right? And which cross out. Then there's other ones like Echidna and so forth. So that sort of simple, broad space is rich with known song lines, right? Laced with them. And then if I just go to that, the top of that little pink one, that's actually called Nagara Nagara. Kim would know. It's now called Seven Sisters, but it's an isolated dream, exactly the same. It's about an old Jagamaran man who chases and harasses women. But it's only that small. I don't believe it connects up to Seven Sisters, but curiously, it's a localised, determinative religious tradition. Now, if I zoom in there, just for the sake of how this manifests itself, so it's a little line for me because I'm trying to symbolise it. And if I have the wrong thing, if I go in, it looks like that. On the ground, right? And then if you can kind of imagine, I'll give you this, the rock country, that there, this and that. Looks like that, in real terms, or actually as you travel on country, very sacred location, some of these, and obviously, but not secret, we all live there and camp there, but the person now, one, you would know her bye-bye probably. Yeah, well, so she expresses and represents that country, it's like that, right? And it's a representation for her of just the ceremonial component, basically the decorative component of the women in law. So I know where I was going with that, but all I was trying to do is convey difference in perception of landscape and story. Now, okay, so I'm going to go back to a different version of the same thing. So these are the big dreamings, right? And the large, like Red Kangaroo, very important male ritual. Wadi Kudra, the same, two men. And men and women you can see there, which is lucky, my map is roughly the same as yours in the exhibition. It comes out from the Pilbara through Māori country down into Warbling country here. It goes down onto the Nullarbor where the women fly. I'll show you some photos in a minute because by chance I was working with Numidja and Lala Western a long time ago, and then it comes down up and back up in the desert, goes right down to where I live, which is off the map, down the very tip of the peninsula, and goes back up to Port Augusta, transforms, returns, and that's where you get different. Some of these are seven, some of these are two. I try to trick the men once in the bush, because often when you're lying in the bush and you look up at those seven sisters, you can only see six stars most of the time. And I'm going to trick them to see how good they are. So I said, look, how come I only see six stars? And they go, no, they'll find them, the
one he likes the most, she often goes with him and spends the night.
That's right. And obviously there's Seven Sisters and then there's Pleiades, but there's also Taurus in between, which is part of that story.
So it splits and comes back. Here is two women as a love moon myth that is, and then it transforms, moves up right up the Gulf of Carpentaria. So it's a massive story.
Now, senior law people
I know, can certainly talk about the law and know it at least in detail across at least 3,000 kilometres of that journey, and maybe longer. So the people that I work with here, and I took them down to my place once, my local community, which is quite conservative, wanted to have an anniversary, so they wanted some Aboriginal people in the parade, you know, to show that they were there before. I said, no, exactly. I was like, oh, no, but Scott, you know something about Aboriginal, so can you get some? So
that's true. So I said, well, I'll bring some people down from the desert who know the law here. I didn't know if they did, and they can actually sing The Country That You Farm, right?
So they did. They came down, right? And to my complete shock, so it's that mob, same mob that in your thing. They came down, and this is, my country looks different. Well, let's go here first.
So this is the laid law mob. This is Coolyroo,
weirdly, that you've got on your display, that top one, which I've got a gap, right? And this is Minyunati, where the women come and dance and then dance across. And this young child here, I thought it might be one of the ladies, but we've grown up, but she's consubstantial. She's actually one of the Seven Sisters. And there's Milma to there. So weirdly, same mob.
Right. Anyway, so we move from there, right up in Warburton, come down to where I live on the coast. We're near a place called Coffin Bay, which people know maybe because they've eaten oysters there. And the country looks different. I live just behind this mountain. And I always thought this was Seven Sisters, but I get there, and the man goes, no, it's not Seven Sisters. It's
Kajiulenya, which is actually the son of, so the two, Wadinyiru, the son is often a penis, often a snake, or the son Yula. And Pitjantjatjara, when they finish a word with an A, a consonant, they'll add N-Y-A on the end. So the name's really Yula. It said Yula Nyat. And it blew my mind that they knew the name. And I mean, they are 2,000 kilometres from where they live, they've never been there before. And they not only just knew the name of the place, but after, you can see in the body language how adamant they are, intense they are in talking about it, but they also walked to this location defining particular events in the landscape. And I told the local farmers that, and they're like, my God, my farm is called Yulena. And the plains are called Yulana, and the water basin in Port Lincoln is called Yuli Basin. So the sacred name is in our own geography, but all the local people thought they got it from Matthew Flinders. But that's a remarkable thing, right? And these were taken off, normal prints, so they're a bit old. But the interesting thing about this is, I wonder if I was just being up there with some old men, but look at the number of kids and middle-aged people. So the future-proofing kind of goes on, and sometimes you don't notice it, sometimes you think it's all old people, but actually the young people are part of it. Cool. So, my next question for developing the theme of future-proofing is, what does this ritual geographic knowledge mean in human terms? Now, for me it means, and I think this is an important thing, I don't know, I'll test it on you guys, right? It means to me that songlines are an interactive geographic form of mythology. Now, they link important and valuable places and countries and people over thousands and thousands of kilometres. And they, unlike any other religious device that I'm aware of, which isn't all that many, they necessitate social and political cohesion. Now, the spiritual and environmental well-being of every group is dependent on the spiritual and environmental well-being of the group next door. Now, each, in a sense, is an independent religious chain that encompasses, as I've demonstrated, an area about the size of Europe. Now, songlines for me are thus ultimately... Oh, 2 minutes left. God, I've got to go quick. All right. Okay, well, I'll say this really fast. I didn't realise I was talking so much. I'm terribly sorry. Okay, so my view is that songlines are more than stories. They're actually powerful religious vehicles for determining traditional law and determining rights in land, that they link people together in a way that's so cohesive that it actually engenders, with classificatory kinship, the most unique religious device on earth. Aboriginal people are, as far as I know, the only people on earth, and this is their contribution to the world, that have a religious and communal system of laws which actually form cohesion and is, by definition, harmonious. You can't have social conflict because your own religious beliefs are destroyed.
So I'm going to flick through now really quickly. We'll have to come back. And I was going to say here, oh, my God, so much to talk about. Just very quickly, the black is basically exclusive name title. The grey through the middle is land rights. That is as good as freehold title. That country is owned by Aboriginal people and have complete control over it. And it's based on, it's articulated through strong lines. The whole north, if you look at the land, almost all the land from the top of the Pilbara to Cape York is Aboriginal owned. The entire northern defensive seaboard of Australia is basically Aboriginal land. And if you think of that in political, geographic terms, it's a massively powerful position, all articulated by songlines. So the importance of songlines go a long, long way, in my mind, beyond the sort of pleasantry of we human, we tell stories. It's actually a profoundly important socio-political device. Now, quickly, I move on. Okay, I'll go back. I happened to be on Opelli last year, and for the first time in 20 years, there was a ritual exchange. And people were coming up from Woomba, 17-hour journey to Oumpelli to pay back a gift. That was the original ritual gift. It was a little bit of hair of a child. Now, the people bringing the ritual back were all young people. The gift was given to the father. The fathers didn't pay the debt off. But the next generation did, and they arrived and performed a ceremony for 7 days, and I just happened to be there. Look at the age of participants. The leader there is young. The dancers are young. Really young, and they were playing didge for 6 hours a day. It went for 6 days, and the whole dance included things like looking out to sea, looking through telescopes, waving goodbye, pulling anchors, and rowing boats. And it's like, what is this about? And the gifts that were given back to that little bit of hair, and that bit of hair had been kept for 20 years. Like Aboriginal people are famous for losing stuff. Right? But the gifts were kind of sheets. Those terrible Mickey blankets, those thick furry blankets that you get, doonas, what's the go? And what it was, in this young generation, the same ceremony that was performed 300-400 years ago for the Macassans. It's about the arrival of the Macassans and the Macassans being silks and sarongs and woven mats and exchanging them, and they're still performing the same ritual exchange. So as a sort of symbol of future-proofing, I think the circumstances and the importance of the law in basically becoming a traditionally educated Aboriginal person is growing and growing and growing. And this is proof of the understanding and the coolness of Aboriginality in the context of its own law. So sorry if I went too long. Done. I've got to do something here with this. Hit one more slide.
I learned a lot, and this is what I hope the day does for everyone. We all have little different bits of the elephant. So, no question, it would have deepened our understanding the different parts that people work in. And I just think that the nature of that contemporary activity, you know, how active it still is quite extraordinary, and the engagement of young people to the extent that it was. But the one that really gets me is the mob knowing the Adelaide area. So that's clearly where we're going to go next. And it's just like all the things we're going to hear today, we're only skimming the surface, but they're stimulators for further learnings. Does anyone want to make a particular comment or question or happy to hang around? Just got a minute.
My name's Mark England. I was really struck by the comment that if there's conflict between the different groups, then that destroys the religion. So it undermines the group, so you can't have conflict, which is just a quick passing comment, but a really substantial one.
Chinese gunpowder and gunpowder and compass and you know and what Romans concrete and
and the British maybe the internet and you know, so forth. So what do the Aboriginal people contribute, their greatest contribution to humanity? It's that system, that religion and a classificatory system of kinship, which is another thing to go into, means that everybody here is by definition, even though we don't, if you tell me you are, say, Jagamara, I know instantly you're my grandfather. And I behave to you like that. And if that would be for everybody. And you can be in a situation, if you're part of that kinship system, anywhere and say, I was talking to a friend of mine, Tracy, who's working in Albury Wodonga with a man called Sam Jubarula, and I know my relationship to him. So by that and this sort of codependent religious tradition means that they've developed a system that is kind of completely anti-conflict. I mean, there is conflict. There's always conflict amongst groups over women and over infringement of some ceremony, a totemic. If you go and damage a site, they will kill you. So there's conflict in the maintenance of the law, but there's that reciprocity in the system that I might actually have to kill you, but you're his brother there, but we've got to perform the ceremony so like we get over it. Right? So it's actually a harmonious system, and there's no system on. I think, I know this is being filmed, so I shouldn't say this, but I think the whole issue with Invasion Day is missed in that context, because it wasn't a point of conflict. I imagine Aboriginal people kind of welcomed, as they welcomed me the first time I went to the desert. It's like, you're a strange white person. I wasn't a missionary. I got given this kinship. No, I was welcomed. And that's their contribution to me. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Please, yeah. Oh, interdependent, thanks. Yeah, good. Yeah, no, it is true. I couldn't give you an idea.
Hi, I'm Sue, and I do have young Kinjajara children through my ex-partner and a big family, so that's part of why I'm here. But just also I travelled here with a friend who lives with an elder just north of Port Augusta, and not to be too controversial, but looking at the other side of where, like, you've probably been involved with a lot of native title that you feel has had positive outcomes, but you know where there's places where people are almost seen as twisting the kinship, or the white fellas go up north and get initiated with this other tribe and come back and say, that's our country now, and all that kind of thing. Is that sort of an example of how the falling apart of the religious kinship, the properness that does stop, that keeps things peaceful, and now we're getting that ripping apart when native title has had a bad effect on people masking their real kinships and mixing it all up and so on?
Yeah. I was going to talk a little bit about that, but for me, because I've seen the same thing, and you see people from the urban fringe rush up and get initiated and come back, and there's suddenly big waddies, you know. And like, but also I've seen that now play out over a couple of decades, and I was always concerned that the sort of expansion of the domain, the religious domain, was diluting it. But over time, what happens is those people start getting a little bit kind of, there's obligations on them, and there's and they become part of it. So I think on balance, you know, it's certainly a fraught journey, which is the nature of its political dimension. I mean, it's not a clean line. But over really what's happening here with the Songlines exhibition is Western Desert people asserting their political authority beyond Kulyu. You know, they're talking here now with power. That's the process. And for me, that's kind of wonderful and ingenious. And probably you're part of the kinship network now. So I think it's a fraught.
That's being another site, and it's the way it is spoken about. It's now part of the songline. Yeah. So any of these new sites and new people all get folded in as the ongoing story. So, thanks very much, Scott. Now we need to. You can pick up on any. I've got one of these. We can pick up on. Just hold those ideas and thoughts, and we'll pick up on them. At the end of the time, you might have to make a choice between coffee or talk, but you know, life's all about choices. So, Professor John Bradley is going to talk to us next, talk with us, about us. I first came across John, I only met him today, and I didn't recognise him because the photo I saw in the book he did about saltwater country was when he was a young school teacher in Borroloola, and it was about 38... No, he was there for 38 years. So where are you, John?
Yeah.
So I can talk about you with you in mind. So he looks a little different from then, so clearly I didn't recognise him. I was absolutely intrigued, you know, because I went up into Arnhem Land as school teachers and with my husband in early 70s. So I kind of have a sense of that time and place, although it's a different place, certainly the same kind of time. And everyone looked different and wore funny clothes and had long hair everywhere. And men wore little tight shorts and long white socks. And, you know, it was all... I know. I won't tell you what I wore. It was disgusting. And lots of wiglets and false eyelashes. You know, all that stuff, you know. As you would in Arnhem Land, of course. So I kind of got a real sense of it, and I was intrigued, and I'm not going to steal his thunder, because I don't even know what his thunder is today, but I can't really steal it, because he spent 38 years, he didn't go up as an archaeologist or an anthropologist, and I'm not putting him down at all, but that wasn't his intent. He was there for different reasons, but school finishes early, as you know, and you have long holidays, and in those days you didn't have to do a lot of work after school, because they didn't have all that admin-y stuff they have now. So he obviously got very absorbed, and this book is fabulous. You should. I just get the right, the actual. Singing Saltwater Country. And he was mapping song lines and stuff with all the old fellas, and must have made an enormous contribution by virtue of the fact that he didn't just leave his teaching post and that was the end of that. He actually continued and is now the Deputy Director of the Monash Indigenous Centre at Monash University, and this Borroloola experience was in the 1980s. So what we'll do is we'll put some of these bios up on the web so that I don't bore you too much with reading them out. But anyway, he will speak for himself. Thank you very much, John Bradley.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Kim. Thank you, Scott. My journey's a bit different, really, because we're going to leave the desert. I work in saltwater country, and things change when we get into that country. So I could have chosen any place at all to talk about, but I thought Manungurra is a really good place because it was really, really important to Yanyuwa people that I've worked with back into the 60s, right back. In fact, today it's called Canberra. This is the Canberra of Yanyuwa country, and partly because of the cycad palms and the ability to provide enormous amounts of food for the gatherings of many, many hundreds of people for ceremonies and things like this. It's got a bigger story because it's one of the first ever places in recent times where we tried new technologies, new ideas to try and bring that place to life, and that's what I want to finish with. And my whole talk is really about young people and old people. This is the conversation. But I better pay some homage to the Seven Sisters. And in the Gulf Country, that's the Seven Sisters, the blue-ring octopus. And they're very powerful, very poisonous. When you poke a blue-ring octopus, they light up like stars. They have many names, each name meaning special things. And in fact, the first song I ever heard in 1980, the first time I ever went bush, was being woken up in my swag at 4 o'clock in the morning by a group of elderly men and women singing the Seven Sisters as they rose in the eastern sky in the cold season. And they were singing it because that song recreates the earth anew. And if any babies are nearby, they're grabbed and they're tapped, and it's meant to make the baby strong as well. It also has men's business, it also has women's business, but that's the Seven Sisters. I have to acknowledge this old lady, and I should also acknowledge in the audience, I saw him arrive, John Moriarty, a Yanyuwa elder, somewhere up the back, somewhere, I saw him. But he will know this old lady. This is my number one mum, one of the hardest teachers I've ever had in my life, who knows what I'm doing here today and said, well, that's your business, but who has really been the driving force in a community where now she represents only one of three elders who now speak the language Yanyuwa. And that's more complex because Yanyuwa is one of the only languages in the world that has completely different dialects for male and female. So she's a woman speaker. She knows the insides out of men's songlines. You know, so many times we would listen to men singing, and people like Dinah are singing under their breath. They would never sing aloud, but they would sing under their breath. They knew, she knew what was being sung, how it was being sung, and what was going on. And Singing Saltwater Country, that book, really came about after all the last old songmen had died. And people like Dinah and others didn't think the job was finished. And my job over the last 10 years is really still working with songlines, and that's what I want to do today, is just give you an example of the kinds of stuff that Dinah and others of her generation are doing. But to speak of songlines, what does it mean in language to speak of a songline? You know, Gujiga in Yanyuwa, but Gujiga can also mean just a verse. As Scott rightly said, it can also be a person. You can point at a magpie and say, that's Gujiga. You can point at a kangaroo and say, that's Gujiga too. It's all got song. The path of the song is a road. So when you sing, you follow the path. And somebody that really sings brilliantly literally swallows the essence of the song. And you, if you've ever seen old men when they're singing powerfully, you see that they're right there. They're the dingo, they're the kangaroo, whatever they are, they're it. And this is how I entered the world. I was fascinated arriving in Yanyuwa country, and there was another language to learn. And so I entered this world via language. In Yanyuwa, at least, songlines can never be spoken of as past tense. They can never be spoken of as present tense, as future tense. They are always present. They never go away. They are always there, sitting there. Even if no one is singing them, they are still there. They're running, if you like a pipeline of water through the ground. And if you are a human being who knows how to sing, you are the tap. And the song amplifies itself through you. So always present tense, and I could go on with these words because there's also a very complex series of markers, directional markers, north, south, east, west, that can also fit to this. And then how do we talk about people that know? So the songs are always sitting there, a person who is a singer of songs, the song sits in their mouth, it sits on their tongue, it's not in their head. It sits on their tongue, ready to sing. Always in the present tense. So these are the public songlines in Yanyuwa country. There are some restricted ones, but we haven't marked them. And so, wherever this little doodie-dad is, how do I turn it on? Right. So these are the public songlines, and I've just done something I shouldn't have done. But that's all right. Manangura is down here, and that's where we're going to go. But you can see, as Scott said, there's ribbons. And another way I would describe a songline, for the Yanyuwa at least, is they are ecological ribbons of knowledge. They are full of environmental knowledge, meteorological knowledge, scientific knowledge of all kinds. And one of the ways I got really interested in them was when people were singing in them and saying, that animal's not there anymore. We sing it, but it's gone. Where'd it go? Oh, maybe white fella took it away. And I began to understand extinction of species through understanding songlines. And I had one experience where I'd sat, there's a big debate about a particular bandicoot in this country, whether it ever existed by the scientists. And Yanyuwa people say, we got a song for him, we sing him, we know him, but he's not here anymore, he's gone away. Where'd he go? Well, maybe white fellas took him away in a box. And I happened to know a fellow who arrived from Alice Springs the next day that comment was said at the first, and he was there to do mammal surveys, had a whole lot of stuffed mammals that he pulled out of the back of the car. And the first one he pulled out of the box was the golden bandicoot. And people just said, see, told you. So one of the things in Yanyuwa country, though, that is confusing people sometimes is there's a big difference between what is a dreaming path and a song line. They don't always match. So the red line is the dreaming path of the tiger shark. But the green line is the actual song. So the tiger shark travelled, gets to Manangura, stands up and then sings backwards. He doesn't travel. He just sings the song back over the country that he knows is his. And this happens over and over again in Yanyuwa country. There are times when there are no dreamings carrying the song at all. The song is its own force. The song has its own agency rolling through the country. There is no kangaroo singing it. There is no dingo singing it. It's just the song wanting to move. So we get into sort of certain levels of abstraction in regards to this. Now, one of the big issues in this country is there are no singers. There are no men left who know any songs at all. We have all the recordings, and there was always debate about whether recording was good. I have had old men saying, nope, kids can't learn, they don't get it, end of story. That tape is no good. And one of the reasons they didn't like the tape is because of all the conversations that surround singing. Singing isn't passive. There's all sorts of other stories told. So as the old men died, people got more worried. We'd recorded, we'd transcribed, we had lots of pages of songs that were mute. And what I realised is if when I got to know a lot of young people, they said, well, I'm going off with those old men. They don't tell you anything. They don't tell me what they're singing. Why should we go? They can't teach us. Because for the old men, singing is just so much fun. It's where they need to be. And for young people, say, what are you singing, Grandad? It just stops the event. And what I come to realise too is in a community where language was no longer being spoken, kids didn't know a lot of the detail of their own country anymore. The different birds, the different fish, the different animals, all the things that made up a song. And so I took upon myself to start drawing. Now you could say, well, why didn't Indigenous people, Yanyuwa people themselves draw? I'll tell you a short story. I've always drawn sketchbooks full of drawings. And I was on my veranda once drawing, and an old man came up behind me and he said, who do you want to kill? And I said, nobody. And he said, well, must be you got to kill somebody. And I said, why? He said, we don't draw in this country. Don't draw. The acrylic art movement now does exist at Borroloola, but people are very careful that they do not paint dreamings. There is too much politic. So the crazy white fella can draw all he likes. And that's good. People like this. Now, these illustrations are work in process, but it illustrates what we decided to do with the song lines. We decided to draw them and everything that we could find that could be sung. So that kids, when they look at these things, these are actually A3. We've got plans to actually make them much, much bigger, like big scrolls of lore, if you like, borrowing from the Torah scrolls, where they're meters long. But at least we could start to say to the kids, this is what's being sung. The text up the top is translation, a literal translation from the owners of the songs. Because I found out, actually asking people, where does that song travel? You got great stories. Not just the singing of it, but where does it travel? What does it do? How does it move? And so it starts at Manangura, and it sings the freshwater well. It sings old people getting water. I'm going to show you an animation of just this part here at the end. And you can see the bend of the river, thank you to Google Earth. And then it goes down into the river, and it travels now downstream. And you can see, coming down at the eastern bank of the river, the song line circles. It's active, it's present, it is doing. Even now, as I stand here, it's still doing this. And so all the place names become apparent. What happens at these place names becomes apparent. How things move. And there's all sorts of relationships here. Why does a crocodile live under a flying fox colony? Easy feed. So when you really start to look at things, you start to see all sorts of other interrelationships that these songs express. And so we've drawn now every public song line, huge portfolios of them, all mapped. This is where my life is at the moment. All mapped, all done. My wife was actually the colourist. She did all the colouring. Because at first I thought black and white ink, easy to draw, and people wouldn't look at them. There was no depth. There was no resonance. So I actually paid my wife as an RA to colour. And it was a really important thing to do, because as soon as people saw the colour ones, they interacted immediately. This is country. It's alive. It's doing something. And then we head out the river mouth. Now we have song lines in the sea. And I think this is a really important point. We talk about Terra Nullius, but we also had Mare Nullius for a long time as well, that the sea was owned by nobody. But when you see these song lines that are moving out into the sea country, you're dealing with people that know this country. This is country. This is a place. This is an active place. And the drawings are good because you can see species. But the drawings, it's more difficult to because they sing the movement of the tides, they sing the currents, they sing all sorts of other sort of other phenomena that are a bit harder to represent. Whales, all sorts of things, rainbow serpents are all in here. Now, just as a point here, this is a really interesting point, not just because it's politics where clans hand over, but there's a species of shark here, and this one here, that when we drew it, I had an ichthyologist friend, and I said, well, that shark is there, and he said, no, it couldn't have been. And I said, well, we found a dead one because it's smelly, but we took a photo. Here's the photo. No, you couldn't have. And I said, well, we did. And we got songs for it, and people have stories for it. And he said, but you couldn't have. And I said, why? He said, because we haven't discovered it there yet. And he was deadly serious. 10 years later, a PhD student of his found one. And the first thing they rang up and said is, can we call the Latin name by the annual name, please? And people went, well, why? You didn't believe us in the first place. So this is a sort of a site of tension that can exist in these different knowledges that we are dealing with. So we come onto an island now, this island of Vandalen Island, and we cross over Vandalen Island, and this song is still travelling, it's still there right now. And it goes back out to the sea and circles around a little while, and then it comes back onto the land. And it goes into this big freshwater lake where this huge rainbow serpent lives. Now, the idea of this thing being active is actually really important. When this song is sung, they describe the rainbow serpent in incredible detail, but after every verse they sing him, they also sing a verse that stops him from getting angry. So every verse is accompanied by, stay there, mate. We know you're there and we don't want you to hurt, because this is the bringer of cyclones. This is the bringer of bad weather, danger, nasty things. So this is where we're up to in the Gulf country, where colonial impact has been immense, where languages are not being spoken, and yet people know the centrality of song in their life. We don't know where this is going to go. Out of the 13 public song lines we have mapped and drawn, through the use of this material, one group of young men now sing. And because they can sing, initiation ceremonies can still happen. But it has been a huge effort on their behalf. Maps, tapes, travelling onto country, huge effort, and yet they're doing it. But of course, the old people are so critical. Are they soft? You know, they've got soft tongue. They can't say the words like they're meant to be said. But they're really proud, and on the off moment, the grandmas are still proud too. But they're harsh critics. If this is going to be done, do it properly. So out of the 13 song lines that we have recorded, we have mapped, we have drawn, we've done everything with, one has come alive. And that's an enormous effort on behalf of young men, young women too, being prepared to engage with a multiplicity of technologies. So where I want to leave you is with, somewhere here, I don't know where it's gone, Luke? Play is with probably the first ever animated song line in the history of Australia. Part of what I do in my other job at Monash is using animation to help record Indigenous languages for prosperity. And hopefully it will work. Yeah?
We'll recap.
And this is Manangura, but the song line is just going round and round in one place. It hasn't even begun its journey yet. Thank you.
Hola,
just tell one story here about this animation. It was with great trepidation we took it back into the community because this is the first one that was ever done. And we go back to the photo of Dinah, and Dinah is the senior woman in charge of this song. And we all filed into the room. We put it in the TV. There was about 40 people, and there was dead silence, and everyone is watching Dinah, who stayed mute. And I'm going, not working, until those bubbles floated. And when she saw the bubbles, she looked at me and she said, "You've got it." And from then on, the rest is history. Thank you.
I'm reeling. I can see why people are commenting, asking questions. How do you process all that? But if you do have a burning, if you want to talk about it now, we also have quite a session at the end of the day if you want to, you know, allow some things to settle in the glass of the brain and then bring it up. But we have the lady. Oh.
Yes, oh, thank you. I'm not used to speaking in a microphone. I'm really interested, John Bradley, thank you very much. I've got your book and it's all highlighted and I absolutely love it. You say the song seemed to have its own presence. Is the song like spirit, the essence or something? Or is that reading too much into it? Is it more than just a group of words?
Well, it's always more than... Going? Yeah, it's always more than a group of words. Look, I don't know how to think about this in my own head a little bit, except that once I really quizzed an old man, and this is a literal translation of what he said from Yanua. He said, "Look, understand it travels merely by itself. It does not need a dreaming to carry it." And then he went on and he said, "The crow does not carry it," because we're dealing with one of his own songs. "The wedge-tailed eagle does not carry it. Merely the song travels by itself, but then it will pick up the crow and sing it and leave it. It will pick up the wedge-tailed eagle and sing it and leave it, and then it will merely travel by itself again."
So that sort of leads into my next question. Does the song need a person to sing it?
The human is the amplifier.
Yeah, okay.
But it's important to understand the song is always there.
Mm.
It's not going to go away.
So, okay. Yep. So, sorry. Thank you.
Now, we're just running over for coffee break. I know there's some people, other people burning here. Can you hold it and either catch him at coffee or if you don't burst at the seams, hold it till the end of the day to share it with us all? Sorry about that. But I'm sure you'll agree that was a very rich examples of how they work, how song lines work on country over time, and how some of the challenges of the transfer of knowledge is being overcome for the next generation. So you go to the coffee will be a bit brief, I think, because it takes people, because you have to wander there and wander back. So try and wander fast. Would that be good? Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.